Tuesday, the 6th of February. We have, we have a work session noticed, but I understand there's further work to be done before that bill can be moved, so we will not be opening the work session today. But we will be setting it over just until tomorrow. So for anybody who's following House Bill 2357, that bill will be brought to work session at our meeting tomorrow, Wednesday the 7th. We'll take the hearings on the remaining bills in the order in which they appear on the agenda. We'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2366. Council Kelmanson.
Thank you, Chair McPherson. HB 2366 provides that extensions of statute of limitations that exist in actions brought by children also apply to actions brought by parents, guardians, or conservators for the recovery of the child's medical expenses if those expenses resulted from the same wrongful conduct that is the basis of the child's action.
Scott Pratt here from the Oregon State Bar. Mr. Pratt?
Thank you. Chair McPherson, members of the committee, I'm Scott Pratt from the Oregon State Bar, specifically the Procedure and Practice Committee. We are proposing, I'm sorry, HB 2366 is our proposal to clarify the law. As it stands right now, there's an extension of the statute of limitations for minors and insane people, as it's described in the statute, that gives additional time on the theory that those persons may not adequately understand the nature of their rights and gives them more time to bring their claims. Subject to certain limitations. There has been an argument made, as you might imagine, in many cases with children, parents pay the medical expenses for injuries incurred in an accident. There's been an argument made that the extension that applies to children does not apply to the parent's recovery of medical expenses on the basis that that's really the parent's claim, not the child's claim, and the statute in question, ORS 12-160, only extends the claims of the children. So this is a clarification to make sure that the parents can also have that extension only for medical bills related to that particular claim. There were a couple other little modifications just to clarify some things, because in the statute as it exists, 12-160, it kind of groups children and insane persons together, and that created some little oddities where it said, I think the word used was the, in regards to insane, was the incapacity, which didn't seem to apply equally to children, so it was separated out. The basic language is separated out into five sections, but the key thing is the extension of the time frame for parents to bring their claim. It also addresses a potential issue that might arise. There was an appellate court decision a few years back that said in regards to a claim, you had to bring all of your claims at the same time. For instance, in an auto accident, you could not bring your claim for the damage to the vehicle at one time and later on bring the claim for the injuries that you might have suffered to your person. And so in order to make sure that doesn't apply here, where the parents might be forced to bring a claim early, and then the child might also have to bring their claim early, which would defeat the whole purpose of 12-160. That's why we were also approving it. So that's the gist of this proposal.
Okay. Mr. Pratt, just sort of fuller background, is it typically the parent's cause of action for the medical care or long-term care, for example, where there's injuries that need care over time, rather than the child's claim?
Yeah, it is the parent's claim that we're looking at. The injuries, they will pay often in order to get medical care for their child. So they're paying the bill even for the child's care. And so that's what this addresses, is the parent's recovery of those expenses, those bills that they have been paying for the child.
And a claim by a third-party insurer or a self-insured employer-provided plan would not be affected by this.
This does not address those there. We didn't try to make this very expansive. It was meant to deal with a kind of a narrow issue.
Right. And the statute of limitations otherwise would be how long?
Well, it depends on the claim. This 12160 extends any statute of limitations for a child or an insane person, regardless of what it might grow out of. In this case, the typical ones are going to be for injuries, so it's going to be a 2-year statute of limitations in regards to medical expenses. I suppose it's possible, I really thought it through, a contract claim potentially could get in there, which has a 6-year statute of limitations. But it's meant to say it's all related to the same incident that affected the child or the insane person.
Mm-hmm. Any members? Any questions for Mr. Pratt?
No.
I don't see any. And why don't you just, since you're, I think, the only person signed up for the next couple of bills here, why don't you just hold your place there while we...
I'll get the rest of my testimony.
Okay. That's all the public testimony we have signed up for House Bill 2366, so I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2366. And open a work session on House Bill 2366. This is really just expanding the tolling of the statute of limitations to claims by the parents beyond to pair up with claims by the children. If that seems as logical to you as it does to me, then I would invite a motion to move it due pass to be put on the consent calendar.
Mr. Chair, I do move that committee pass House Bill 2366 to the floor with a due pass recommendation and placed on the consent agenda.
Representative Wisnett has moved House Bill 2366 to the floor with a due pass recommendation to be placed on the consent calendar. Is there any discussion? If not, the clerk will call the roll.
Representative Bonamici. Aye. Representative Cameron. Aye. Representative Flores. Aye. Representative Cox. Aye. Representative Creaker. Aye. Representative Reed. Aye. Vice Chair Barker. Aye. Vice Chair Wisnett. Aye. Chair McPherson. Aye. House Bill 2366
is reported to the floor with a due pass recommendation to be placed in the consent calendar. I now close the work session on House Bill 2366. Open a public hearing on House Bill 2367. Council.
Thank you, Chair McPherson, members of the committee. House Bill 2367 provides that the council and court procedures, which promulgates the rules of civil procedure, the Oregon Rules of Civil Procedure, the bill provides that the council can take action on all matters other than the promulgation of rules after an affirmative vote by a majority of the members who are present at a meeting, so long as a quorum is present.
Mr. Pratt, start out by identifying yourself for the record, even though you identified yourself before.
Again, Chair McPherson, members of the committee, I'm Scott Pratt from the Oregon State Bar Procedure and Practice Committee. What we're proposing with House Bill 2367 is a modification to ORS 1.7302A. As you can imagine, most committees, when they have a quorum present, can take action. And they take action by a majority vote of the members present. As it presently reads, ORS 1.7302A appears to require for the Council on Court Procedures that a majority of the members vote for an action in order for it to be effective. Therefore, even if a quorum is present and a majority of that quorum votes for the action, it may not be effective because it might not constitute a majority of the committee. And so the proposed change here is to state when a quorum is present, a majority of those present is the action of the Council on Court Procedures. So it's a little clarification in the law. That's the gist of it.
Okay. Any questions about that explanation?
Sure.
Representative Cameron.
Yeah.
from another committee, and I, Representative Barker might help me with this, but I think we had heard testimony about this group of people having a difficult time getting together anyways, and they were getting together via the phone. Can you talk a little bit about?
I can talk a little bit about it. I've attended a few of those meetings a couple of years ago, and it's a very large committee. It has appellate court judges, trial court judges, various attorneys. It tries to have participation from around the state, and it's sometimes difficult. It's not that difficult to get a quorum present, and people do appeal by telephone, but can be some contentious matters that are decided by a majority vote. But if there's, and I can't tell you the exact numbers, but by way of example, if they have 15 people present from a 25-person committee, they have a quorum, they can take apparently can take action, take votes, but if the vote is 10 to 5 in favor of something, that's only 10 out of 25 of the committee, and the way the law is written, it would appear that that's not effective because it's not a majority of the committee, unlike most committees where once a quorum is present, a majority vote of those present is there. So, yes, people do attend by telephone, and that's definitely happens here.
Thank you, Mr. Brett. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Lieutenant Barker.
And it's my understanding in reading the summary that this would not apply to the actual promulgation of rules. It's just more your internal procedure stuff. But for the big changes, you would have to have the true quorum of the entire committee, I mean a majority of the entire committee voting.
That's what it says. I believe so. I believe that's what it provides for.
Right. Thank you. I'm supportive of that. Yeah.
Right. That's an existing law on the end of subsection 2A. Affirmative vote of 15 members of the council should be required to promulgate rules.
And just so I can be clear on that, the action of the committee doesn't change the rule itself. It submits the rule to further review, I believe, by the Supreme Court is where they have to take action. So.
Okay. Any further questions? Thank you, Mr. Pratt. I'll now close the public hearing on House Bill 2367 and open a work session on House Bill 2367.
Mr. Chair, I'll move the bill be moved to the floor to do pass and the consent calendar.
Very good. Representative Barker has moved House Bill 2367 to the floor with a do pass recommendation to be placed in the consent calendar. Is there any discussion? Hearing none, the clerk will call the roll.
Representative Bonnici?
Aye.
Representative Cameron?
Aye.
Representative Flores?
Aye.
Representative Plump?
Aye.
Representative Krieger?
Aye.
Representative Reed?
Aye.
Vice Chair Barker?
Aye.
Vice Chair Whitman?
Aye.
Chairman Person?
Aye. House Bill 2367 is moved to the floor with a due pass recommendation to be placed in the consent calendar. I now close the work session of House Bill 2367 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2368. Council.
Thank you, Chairman Clearson, members of the committee. House Bill 2368 provides that a trial court has jurisdiction to decide a motion for judgment notwithstanding the verdict, a motion for a new trial, or a motion for relief from a judgment, even if a party has filed a notice of appeal. Thank you.
Mr. Pratt.
Yes, I'm Scott Pratt from the Oregon State Bar Procedure and Practice Committee. Thank you for letting me testify on House Bill 2368. This one is a bit more complicated than the last couple. The problem arises, and this has been addressed apparently a couple of times, and we need another clarification here. ORS 19-271 states that in most cases, once an appeal has been filed, the appellate courts have authority over the case. But there's a couple of, there's ORCP 71 and ORCP 63 and 64 that state that there are some things that either party can, actions that either party can take after a judgment has been entered. Motions for new trial, motions for reconsideration, and with ORCP 71, motions for relief from judgment. What happens here is there's a question as to whether once those motions have been filed if the trial court can even rule on them anymore because the appellate courts have jurisdiction. At the same time, there's a rule that holds up the appellate court proceedings until those decisions have been made. So it ends up causing a lot of delay in getting from a judgment to an appellate court decision, and it causes a substantial amount of confusion. Sometimes people are filing, sometimes the parties are filing appeals at points in times when they really shouldn't be filing appeals due to these problems with whether the trial court has jurisdiction to even rule on these issues that it would seem that it should be ruling on. So that's what the House Bill 2368 is intended to address. It's to make sure that the trial courts still have jurisdiction to rule on motions for new trial, motions for relief from judgment, and those things, while the appeal is still pending. So we don't have that confusion anymore. The appeal can go forward, but the actions can still be taken at the trial court level.
Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Pratt, what's been happening, practically speaking, in the absence of this new statute, what have the trial courts been doing? Just ruling, assuming that they have jurisdiction to rule on the post-trial motion?
In some cases, they're not ruling, and what ultimately has to happen is to have the appellate court dismiss the appeal, come back, and then go through the process with the trial court, and that can take months to happen. But I will tell you, I can't say that there's a standard that's happening around the state. As with just about anything, there's different interpretations of who can do what, and we're trying to clarify that so everybody knows what the procedure is from court to court.
I guess I'm a little surprised that this is just coming up now. It seems like something that would have worked itself out sooner.
Yeah, I can't tell you the whole history of it. I wish I had a little bit more of that. But sometimes these things happen, and we just don't actually even do. Sometimes there's a procedure that happens, and somebody finds, wait a minute, that maybe isn't the right thing that should be happening, and brings it up on a case, and that discloses the conflict between the statute and the rules in this case.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Counsel?
Yes. Mr. Pratt, my understanding is these statutory amendments are part of sort of a package of amendments to the civil rules that have also been promulgated.
Correct.
That deal with the same issue. Can you speak as to what those are and how they work together?
Well, the Council on Court Procedure, the rules of civil procedure guide a lot of what happens in terms of the trial court procedure, how to present evidence, witnesses, how to do discovery, and all those kinds of things. And so the rules 63 and 64 are going to be amended to make sure the trial court still has jurisdiction over the issues of new trial, even once a notice of appeal has been filed. So that's part of it. But ORS, where we're at here in this bill, is 19270, because it generally grants the appellate court's exclusive jurisdiction. We also need to amend that to provide an exception for actions under ORCP 6364 and ORCP 71. So it is a package of actions that have to be taken to make sure these things interact together.
Okay. We also have Jim Nass from the Judicial Department. Mr. Pratt, why don't you just stay there in case there are any further questions, but let's hear from Mr. Nass on this bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Jim Nass. I serve as legal counsel for the Oregon Appellate Courts. I'd like to second what Mr. Pratt has said about the kinds of problems that the interplay between ORCP 63, 64, and 71 and appeals. And if I could actually speak to the history a little bit, I have been with the appellate courts about 20 years, 21 years now, And I believe it was in 1989 the council amended ORCP 71 to make to try to make clear that, that the trial court would retain jurisdiction to rule on motions for relief from judgment. From our view, that was an excellent thing, because often what would happen is that a case would come up, the appellant would file the opening brief. The respondent looked at that opening brief that had several assignments of error in it and says, you know, he's got a pretty good point. Why don't we go back to the trial court and fix that part of the judgment? Great, except under the law at that time, the trial court wouldn't have jurisdiction to rule on the rule on that motion. So in 1989, the council amended Rule 71 to give the trial court jurisdiction to rule on those motions, even though an appeal was pending. And that indeed helped us out, because that was enabled parties sometimes to resolve an entire case, sometimes part of a case. So it was that much less work that the respondent had to brief, and that the trial court and that the appellate court needed to decide. The part that we really didn't focus on at that time is that ORS 19270 sub 1 raised a question whether merely amending Rule 71 was enough to give the trial court complete jurisdiction to rule on the. So one of the things that this bill does is complement the change made back in 1989 to Rule 71 to make it absolutely crystal clear that the trial court will have jurisdiction to rule on these motions for relief from judgment. Now, you also have these motions for judgment notwithstanding the verdict, which I will call motion JNOV for short, and motions for new trials under Rules 63 and 64. A couple of unique features of these motions is that these motions must be filed no later than 10 days after the date of entry of judgment. Those rules also say that if the trial court has not sooner ruled on those motions are deemed denied 55 days after the date of entry of judgment. When parties timely file these motions and no one jumps the gun by filing a notice of appeal, and either the trial court rules on the motion within the 55 days or the 55 days runs, it's deemed denied and the 30-day appeal period starts and a party files within that 30 days, everything works fine. The problem is that a lot of people get really nervous when they come up to that 30th day from the date of entry of judgment, and they're worrying about losing their right to appeal, and the lawyers are frankly worried about malpractice claims. And so what lawyers will often do, or pro se parties who don't really understand how these rules work, they will file a notice of appeal even though the trial court has not yet ruled on their motion. Well, what two things happened. One, the filing of that notice now deprives the trial court of jurisdiction to rule on the motion, but we can't go forward with the case either. And as Mr. Pratt has said, what we ultimately must do is dismiss the appeal, get the case back to the trial court, at which time the trial court can then rule on it. But the really complicating factor is this. You have this 55-day period that's running along. When the notice is filed, that 55 days stops. When we issue our appellate judgment, the 55 days starts up again. And what a lot of trial courts and parties don't understand, and they don't really think that through, they don't realize that there's a stopping and starting going on. And literally what you have to do under current law is take out your calendar, count the number of days that have gone by since the notice was filed, count the number of days since the appellate judgment was entered, and then figure out when your 30 days starts to run. Typically it isn't the end of the world, because in almost none of these cases do parties actually lose their appeal rights. What it causes is duplicative payment of the filing fee, incursion of attorney fees because they're having to pay their lawyer to do this thing over and over. This bill will solve that problem, because it says the filing of the notice of appeal does not deprive the trial court of jurisdiction to rule on that motion. So what that means is even if somebody jumps the gun, files the notice, the trial court retains jurisdiction to go ahead and rule on the motion, enter an order deciding it, or if the trial court doesn't enter an order, the 55 days eventually will run. I think this will resolve a lot of delay and confusion, and I urge you to support the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Nass. As a result of this bill, assuming this bill is enacted then, what happens to the running of the 30 days for the appeal? Is it still marked from when the original entry of judgment was, despite these other motions, or is it extended until the last action of the trial court?
Mr. Chair, under current law, when a motion for a new trial or a motion for judgment, a motion, JNOV, I'll call it, is timely filed, that renders the judgment non-final until the motion is disposed of. So in many of these cases, we'll probably have to dismiss the appeal anyway. But at least while we're in the process of doing that, that 55-day period will continue to run. And we won't have this stopping and starting, which has just caused so much confusion amongst people who don't have lawyers, and even amongst many lawyers don't really understand how this stop and start thing works.
So is the effect to sort of start over the 30 days? So if somebody files a notice of appeal with the Court of Appeals, but then after that, a JNOV motion is made, that means that until that motion is decided, the time for appeal doesn't start to run. I mean, I understand the effect of the bill is to give the trial court jurisdiction to hear the motion. Their jurisdiction hasn't been taken away by the fact that the notice of appeal was filed. But it sounds like it's the consequence of filing that motion is that the appellate court can't proceed with the appeal, and that the time for filing a notice of appeal from the original trial court judgment doesn't start to run until after the motion is disposed of.
That is correct, Mr. Chair.
Fascinating, isn't it, committee? any questions?
Mr. Chair, not necessarily a question, but the Oregon State Bar, through Susan Graby, had presented us some earlier information that indicates for years when the occasion presented itself through continuing legal education presentations, particularly on appellate law, this has been tried to be addressed at a level to encourage lawyers not to file appeals prematurely, and that has not seemed to resolve the issue. This seems like it's kind of a tightening and putting ducks in a row type of effort. So.
Okay, any other questions or comments, committee? Okay, thank you, Mr. Nass. Mr. Pratt? I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2368 and open a work session on House Bill 2368. And I think one of the questions I throw out for the committee is whether this is appropriate to the consent calendar. It's obviously not something probably anybody is enthusiastic about trying to explain. On the floor.
I was just going to say, Mr. Chair, there's probably two people we might allow to do that.
What's the sense about whether the members would want to know? On the surface of the bill, I guess is the question. Is it's just from the description? Do you think that it will not raise questions in people's minds that they would want to see hear a little explanation on the floor?
Mr. Chair, it's like House Bill, I think it was Senate Bill 480 last time, or 408 on the electrical thing. People never did understand it. You might cause more questions to arise, and I'd put it on the consent calendar to avoid it.
Okay, well, we have a clear statement of preference there. So I will entertain a motion then to that effect.
Mr. Chair, I would move House Bill 2368 to the floor with a due pass recommendation to be placed on the consent agenda.
Representative Flores has moved House Bill 2368 to the floor with a due pass recommendation to be placed on the consent calendar. Is there any discussion? If not, clerk will call the roll.
Representative Bonamici?
Aye.
Representative Cameron?
Aye.
Representative Flores?
Aye.
Representative Cox?
Aye.
Representative Krieger?
Aye.
Representative Reed?
Aye.
Vice Chair Barker?
Aye.
Vice Chair Wisman?
Aye.
Chair McPherson?
Aye. House Bill 2368 is moved to the floor with a due pass recommendation to be placed on the consent calendar. I'll close the work session on House Bill 2368 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2423.
Council. Thank you, Chair McPherson, members of the committee. House Bill 2423 amends the laws dealing with the notice or the notices that agencies must send parties in contested cases. There are a number of amendments, it's my understanding, coming down on this bill, but my description is how it is now, and I encourage the witnesses to correct me if anything I'm saying is going to be changed. HB 2423 provides that agencies must, in contested cases, send parties written notice of the rights and procedures that apply to the case, and included in that written notice must be a statement that whether discovery is or is not allowed. It deletes the requirement that agencies only provide that notice to unrepresented parties. HB 2423 requires a notice to include a statement indicating whether the agency will enter a default order if the party does not request a hearing. It clarifies that the agency record for purposes of a default order includes all materials submitted by a party. It also requires that the officer presiding at a hearing ensure that the record that is developed at the hearing shows that there's been a full and fair inquiry into the facts and the law.
Thank you, Council. We have two witnesses, Karen Berkowitz and Kyle Martin, and that makes sense for both to come up here.
Chair McPherson, members of the committee, my name is Karen Berkowitz. I'm an attorney with the Oregon Law Center, and I think you got a pretty good summary of the changes that the bill makes, but what I'd like to do is just give you a little bit of the history of why we thought this was important. It really started out when some attorneys sat around trying to look at a notice and were trying to figure, well, is this a notice under ORS 183.413 or ORS 183.415, because there are different service requirements. And then in looking at the statutes, we realized that one was really intended to be a notice telling a party what the agency's action is, and the other one was a notice saying, here's when the hearing is, here's what's going to happen at the hearing. But the statutes kind of mixed provisions. Some of the things that should have been in one notice were in the other statute. The other thing that we discovered is that the hearing procedures were really part of a statute about notice. And so we thought that it would be a good idea to separate them out, clarify what goes in each kind of notice, and make sure that the notice of the agency action really had that information, and the notice of the hearing only had information about the hearing. So that's really the reason why this bill came about. The important changes, I think, were well summarized. The statute did not require that the notice of hearing be in writing. It's customary that it is in writing, but we were actually pretty surprised to find out that a hearing notice didn't have to be in writing, and this bill would change that. The notice of hearing also informs the parties whether discovery is going to be allowed. It doesn't change the substantive APA law with respect to discovery, but again, agencies have an option of allowing discovery in a contested case hearing or not, and the parties should be notified about whether discovery will be allowed. The notice the previous version of the statute provided, or the current version rather, provided that a description of the hearing procedure was only required in the notice if the person was not represented by an attorney. And we thought it would be a good idea if everybody got information about what the hearing procedure would be, whether they're represented or not. We also wanted to add a provision in about default, and this is one of the areas that there's going to be an amendment. The original bill said that the notice has to include information about a default if a party doesn't request a hearing, and then in discussion with Department of Justice, we agreed it would be a good idea to set out other circumstances where there could be a default order entered, such as you request a hearing and you don't appear at the hearing, or you request a hearing and you withdraw your request later on. The other change is that the default order currently must be based on a prima facie case on the record, and it's the agency's record. There was nothing in the statute that would require materials submitted by the parties to be included in that record to make a prima facie case. So we added that in because typically in the kinds of hearings I do involve Department of Human Services, the parties do submit evidence to the agency either before they enter an order, make a decision, or sometimes even after they make a decision, there could be evidence submitted to support their position. And in the event of default, this should be part of the total record. Are there any questions?
Any questions of Ms. Berkowitz? Okay. Mr. Martin.
Thank you. Chair McPherson, members of the committee, my name is Kyle Martin. I am the attorney in charge for the business activities section at the Department of Justice. And we're here today to indicate our support for House Bill 2423 with certain amendments that we've proposed, which are designed to avoid certain, we believe, unintended substantive changes to the Administrative Procedures Act, as well as to clarify certain provisions. And I've outlined those in my testimony. I don't know if you would like me to go over any particular one of those changes, but if you have questions, I'm certainly willing to obviously entertain those.
Well, those changes will be coming back to us then at a subsequent meeting. Those are not ready as yet, I understand.
Mr. Chairman, my understanding is there actually was a draft -1 amendment that was done, but I don't know if it where at this point where it's at from Legislative Council standpoint.
I haven't seen a -1 amendment. So.
Yeah, so we're not in a position to move the bill today, and I guess the question is whether it would be helpful to have the amendment language before us when those are explained. That may be preferable to do that, to have it come when it comes back, to have the amendments explained, so we get those on the record.
Mr. Chair,
Representative
I know that I have had a number of constituents who have been caught in the nightmare of administrative hearings process. And looking at the testimony, I just also like the time not only to digest it and see where those issues align with some of the problems that we've seen, but also to see what the amendments might provide.
Okay. Why don't we focus ourselves at this point on the sort of the general context, and if there are sort of questions about how the bill comes forward from the Law Center and the input from the Department of Justice, we could ask those and then take a look at those amendments when they arrive. Any questions of that sort of general background nature? Apparently not. And I would expect ordinarily when we have the Administrative Procedures Act, we might hear from the Administrative Law Section of the Oregon State Bar, and I see Mr. Niebel in the audience. I take it the bar is not choosing to weigh in on this? I see Ms. Gravy, too.
That's correct.
Okay. And is the section aware of the of this bill?
Yes, Mr. Chair, they are aware. They have not taken a position on the bill.
Okay.
Chairman, just to clarify, I'm actually a member of the Executive Committee of the Administrative Law Section and on the Legislative Committee, so we have discussed it with them and they're aware of it.
Okay. Mr. Chair?
Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted a clarification. You're not asking for substantive changes to the Administrative Procedures Act, but the amendments are to make the bill conform with the existing Administrative Procedures Act. Is that correct?
It's really to clarify just the notice and hearing provisions of the Administrative Procedure Act. And it does make very minor changes, but it's really changes to what goes into the notice. But not, you know, in other words, the change to the discovery provision doesn't change discovery under the APA. It just requires the agency to tell the parties what kind of discovery is allowed.
Mr. Martin?
Yes, Chairman Pearson, Representative Bonamici. With the amendments that we are requesting, we don't see anticipating any significant substantive changes.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. Any further questions? If not, I will close the public hearing on House Bill 2423. And since it's not ready to come to work session, that concludes our agenda. And thank you for your attendance. We are adjourned.